support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Dip into your average grocery or convenience store, and you'll have your pick of at least a dozen different brands of bottled water. Maybe you're a Hawaiian shirt and Fiji water kind of person, or perhaps Evian brings back a dash of 1980s glamour.
Keep your body at its peak. Drink Evian.
My next guest argues there's a reason bottled water has become so ubiquitous in American culture. A concerted effort by beverage companies to sell water as a status symbol and simultaneously undermine confidence and investment in the public water supply. In his book Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice, Portland State University professor Daniel Jaffe looks at this history and chronicles the rise of community-led movements to fight the privatization of groundwater for bottling, as well as the struggle for justice in places without access to safe drinking water. Daniel Jaffe, hello and welcome to Soundside. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Libby. It's great to be here.
First off, I just have to say, I love tap water. I weirdly look forward to tasting it in different parts of the country when I travel somewhere. I'm that girl at the restaurant who says, tap is great, before the waiter can even finish asking what I want. And we're especially blessed in the Pacific Northwest with delicious tasting water right out of the tap. But not everybody feels the way that I do. Can you just characterize how popular bottled water has become in America over the last 40 years?
Yes. Well, I start the book by confessing that I'm old enough to remember, you know, growing up in public school, incidentally, in Seattle in the late 70s and 80s, a moment at which there was essentially no such thing as the product of single-use plastic bottled water or packaged water. It was, you know, the early 80s, it was essentially Perrier in those heavy glass bottles, and Americans consumed only 2 gallons per capita on average. Fast forward to today, we are at a moment where Americans on average are consuming 47 gallons per person per year. Nearly 9 in 10 people reports consuming some bottled water. And more dramatically, 1/5 of the population now, 20%, gets all of its plain water from a bottle. They shun the tap completely for all drinking water. And that is up dramatically from only 13% before the Flint crisis.
And what accounts for that shift? Away from just drinking out of the tap and instead choosing to pay for bottled water?
It is a combination of different factors. Certainly, marketing that focuses on everything from health and fitness to youth. I mean, all the standard, you know, tricks of marketers, but also marketing that has cast doubt subtly or overtly about the safety and the quality of public tap water. The critics of the industry call this a war on tap water. It's not all companies. It's not all the time, but it is well documented. Also, the industry, I think, has been the passive recipient of a 4 to 5 decade-long trend in the U.S. of federal disinvestment in our public water systems. The federal government used to fund it at very high levels in the late 70s. Since that point, federal spending on drinking water infrastructure has fallen by roughly 80% when it's adjusted for inflation. And that pressure, that fiscal pain, is sort of pushed down onto cities and states, and many of them do a fabulous job. And certainly, you know, Seattle's a great example. They keep the water quality ultra high, but it leads to deferred maintenance. It leads to aging pipes. The age of pipes around the country is increasing. And that deferred maintenance is very serious. It's something on the order of $3 trillion over the next 2 decades needs to be spent to bring systems back up to snuff. But many cities, especially those with high rates of poverty, low tax bases, can't always make those investments, those necessary investments. And so we do see this breaking through occasionally in the form of drinking water emergencies.
In general, what did you find about the safety of bottled water versus tap?
Let's start with the statistics about tap water safety here in the United States, because despite these dramatically growing fears and significant percentages of the population are concerned about their tap water safety. The vast majority of public tap water in the United States remains safe to drink, and it meets all federal safety standards, well over 90%. It's only something like 7 to 8% of water systems in the U.S. on average in any given year have even one health-related violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act, our main water safety federal law. And those violations don't just happen randomly. They don't occur, you know, spread across the country evenly. They're concentrated in very particular communities, poor communities, low-income communities, and communities, both urban and rural, with high concentrations of residents of color, particularly Black and Latino, Latina residents, and some rural areas with groundwater contamination issues and urban areas with aging pipes. And not surprisingly, those same social groups regularly express the highest levels of concern. And they also spend the most to purchase bottled water, packaged water, despite on average being the least able to afford that extra burden. And it's quite significant by about a 2-to-1 margin. And so it really, to me, suggests that we have not so much a widespread water safety problem as really a water injustice problem here in the U.S.
You write really interestingly about the different regulatory bodies that govern bottled water versus tap water as well. That's probably a conversation for another day. But the fact that bottled water is governed by the FDA, it doesn't have the same regular testing requirements that the EPA has for tap water. And so the, you know, bottled water can have certain, you know, imperfections in it, certain bacteria, things like that, that would not pass muster in tap water. I have to say, I've reported from communities in South Los Angeles who were on small water utilities and been in the room with people, primarily Spanish speaking, who are holding up bottles of the water that came out of their taps that just looked like mud, and asking why there wasn't more attention on what was happening in their specific communities. Whereas, you know, for example, my neighborhood in Los Angeles, the tap water was clear and beautiful and safe. And so I really appreciate that you're saying this is truly an injustice issue in our infrastructure and in the way that we serve these communities.
It's true. And I think that we're not doing ourselves any favor to focus on, say, thinking about people's fears of tap water, particularly among the communities I talked about, low-income communities, communities of color, as some sort of phenomenon of misperception. Now, undoubtedly, it's true. If only 7 to 8% of water systems in any given year have a health-related violation, but 20% of Americans don't drink a single drop of tap water, obviously some people are staying away from tap water that may be perfectly safe to drink. But I don't think it's helpful to focus on a notion of misperceptions, because unless we push the federal government to reinvest in, once again, maintaining our public water infrastructures, restoring our public water infrastructure to trustworthiness for everyone so that everyone can reliably and safely turn on that tap. Until we do that, I think we're not going to resolve the problems. And, you know, last year, for example, even the EPA administrator, Environmental Protection Administrator Regan, told the media, he said, we waited too long to make these investments, and now we've got systemic problems, as well as the acute problems in places like Flint, Michigan, or Jackson, Mississippi, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so important to say those perceptions for those communities are not wrong. They are real things, and they are the result of systemic injustices that are going on. That said, in general, there has also been this campaign by the bottled water industry, which, as I mentioned, is underregulated, to suggest in their advertising that bottled water is always safer than tap water. And you write, that's just not true, right?
It's not. So we have to be a little bit careful, because not all firms have made these claims in their advertisements, and it hasn't been all the time. Sometimes it's industry associations. Sometimes it's subtle implications. But overall, the gist is in that direction. So in the book, I quote one beverage industry representative who said, quote, "One reflection of a healthy beverage industry is the decline of tap water and tap water consumption has been trending down in recent years, unquote. So despite the industry's claims that it's not really in competition with public tap water, in its public statements, often when industry representatives are speaking to each other, they're remarkably candid that their business model and their profits are dependent on dropping tap water consumption across the board. But I did want to get back to your point about the uneven playing field, both in terms of regulation and the mismatch between public water utilities like the Seattle Water Department and beverage firms who sell bottled water. So you're right. Overall, while the standards are roughly equal in terms of the allowable thresholds of contaminants in tap water and bottled water, the regulatory regimes of the FDA regulating bottled water and the EPA regulating public tap water are effectively the difference between night and day. EPA requires public water utilities to test their water dozens, if not hundreds of times per day, to notify the public immediately if contamination is found and to publish those annual water quality reports that you can find online, whereas the bottled water industry is under a much weaker regulatory regime under the FDA as far as inspection and enforcement. Companies do the water testing themselves. The FDA does inspect plants, but inspections have declined in recent years. And overall, there is a vanishingly low chance that the public will be able to find out if contaminants were detected in their bottled water, or if so, what they were, or whether bottled water was recalled. On top of that, I think public water utilities are sort of on an uneven playing field in that, you know, they are often operating on low budgets or modest budgets. The staff, their job responsibilities are essentially to maintain ultra high quality tap water, keep rates reasonable, and do a professional job of maintaining the water system. Profit is not one of their responsibilities, and nor typically is marketing. They're up against well-heeled multi-billion dollar beverage firms with, you know, big legal and marketing departments and multi-million dollar ad campaigns. And I think the result has been that steady drift away from tap water and toward bottled water consumption.
Is there kind of a similar situation with, say, public transportation or other utilities that we just sort of take for granted, and there is such a strong marketing and lifestyle push to adjust our tastes to expect something different or prefer something different when, you know, for example, the thing that's available and that our tax dollars pay for is a really good service?
You know, it's fascinating. If you think about it, water, drinking water, is actually the one thing that local government does, the one service local government provides that is truly essential for life. You could make an argument that public safety goes in that direction too, but really it's water. That is something that has been a central function of local government for more than 100 years in most places. We have the gift of these really precious, well-maintained, in most cases, public water infrastructures that we have paid for and our, you know, forebears have paid for in the form of taxes and water rates. And it really is a precious public good, and it's a public good. And the concern is that if we move toward market control over a substance that's essential for life, when a good that's essential for life is provided mainly or exclusively by the market, that is for profit, access to it then becomes based on the ability to pay. And of course, we know that some people will inevitably go without. And in the case of drinking water, that can be literally in places actually deadly. And so I think we can't risk becoming dependent on the market for access to drinking water. And the fear that I hear from many critics is, where is the tipping point? If you get to 20% of the population in the US don't get any drinking water from the tap, I think, you know, it's not going to be high on their priority list, say, to demand that their public officials spend tax money to invest in keeping that water system at ultra high quality necessary for drinking water. And so there's a fear of losing the political will or the political impetus, if you will, the pressure to keep investing in those systems to keep the water ultra high quality for drinking.
I'm talking with Daniel Jaffe, who's an associate professor of sociology at Portland State University and the author of Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. There's so many issues, of course. Everybody should be by now familiar with where the plastic all goes. So much of this ends up in our oceans. But Daniel, just really quick before we end our conversation, I want to get to this interesting saga that has to do with water supply, and it has to do with a Pacific Northwest community that has kind of fought off the interests of private bottling companies, private water, to tap some of their local supply. And that's the community of Cascade Locks in the Columbia River Gorge area of Oregon. This all started back in 2008. Tell me, what was going on here? It was Nestle. They were hoping to get some kind of a permit for water in this area. What were they trying to do, and what was the community's response?
Yes. So to take one step back, really the heart of this book is a look at the social movements that are the range of diverse social movements that are challenging the growth of bottled water and packaged water, particularly in North America, from two ends. One end is at the consumption end, where this sort of constellation of local initiatives by city governments, nonprofits, and others is sort of fighting to what I call reclaim the tap and restore access to clean drinking water, build out networks of shiny new safe drinking fountains and refilling stations, in many cases ban bottled water consumption by local governments or ban its sale in public places. And that's really taking off, along with sort of the demand for refillable bottles and places to refill them. But the other end of the social movements is at the source, and particularly at the places where the beverage industry, the bottled water industry, wants to bottle or is currently bottling groundwater or spring water. It's worth noting that in the U.S., actually, just over one-third of bottled water on the shelves comes from groundwater or spring water. The rest is just refiltered tap water.
I couldn't believe that when I read it. I was blown away. It's just filtered tap water. Yeah,
exactly. But there is a legal definition of spring water. And for the industry, it sells at a higher price. It's a different market segment. It is more profitable, or at least traditionally has been more profitable. And that's where we tend to see these kind of local flashpoints where communities often have pushed back against industry efforts to access springs and local groundwater. So in two of the chapters in the book, I go sort of deep into stories of the efforts, one in the US, as you mentioned, one in Southern Canada, where one company, Nestle, the world's biggest food and beverage company, and at the time was the US's and the world's biggest bottled water firm, was interested in finding a new source for their Arrowhead spring water brand. Really, it's a 15-year saga of Nestle's attempts to find a source of high-value spring water in the Pacific Northwest, kind of writ large. It starts in 2003 in far northern California in a town called McLeod, where they were ultimately unsuccessful at siting what would have been the nation's biggest bottled water plant, then turned to Washington State, boarded some communities in Western Washington unsuccessfully, then turned to Cascade Locks, Oregon, a hard hit at the time, former mill town, about 1,200 people, high unemployment rate. And really, it was a decade-long attempt to access. Critically, it was state-owned spring water, water used by the state of Oregon for a fish hatchery. It was a complex water swap was going to go on. Nestle would have built a $50 million bottling plant, which would have shipped out about a billion or so bottles a year of Arrowhead spring water to Western Washington, Western Oregon. They didn't have a spring water source in the Northwest. And there was a lot of opposition initially from the state level, folks in Portland and Hood River. And the longer this went on, it was Nestle's decision to access state-owned spring water ultimately was sort of fateful, because it ensured a very long approval process with a lot of opportunities for public input and public comment and opposition. And to cut to the chase, the issue really blew up in about 2015. We had the perfect storm of a big, severe drought. The involvement of several of the Columbia River tribes in concerns around the impact of the bottling on their first food, salmon, and treaty rights around salmon. Several tribal governments got involved, as well as independent indigenous activists. A local coalition came together, the Local Water Alliance, and really was a fascinating sort of tale of rapid grassroots organizing, culminating in a ballot measure on the county ballot in May of 2016 that effectively banned water bottling in the county, in Hood River County. It passed overwhelmingly 69% vote in favor, and then dragged on for another year and a half because local officials, county officials, state officials all vowed to sort of push ahead regardless of the public vote. The coalition sort of mobilized, and eventually, in fall of 2017, Governor Kate Brown put a final stop to the proposal. So to this day, Nestle and now its successor firm, Blue Triton, still don't have a spring water source in the Northwest.
To set the stakes here, I mean, I can understand why local officials, the mayor, a lot of people in the city of Cascade Locks or the town of Cascade Locks wanted to see this bottling plant open. I'm sure it was money for the community. I'm sure it was jobs for the community. What is the downside, however, for a community to permit away water rights?
The messages that were the most successful were threats to the future availability of water in a moment of climate change. The opponents framed the bottling proposal by Nestle as export of water, a loss of control to a distant corporation, and the prospect that the company would set up satellite wells that might threaten groundwater for the high-value agricultural industry in the Hood River Valley, right? The tree fruit and orchards. And so ultimately, this coalition involved local business people, fisher people, farmers, a lot of farmers, local businesses, et cetera, and environmentalists as well. These campaigns were fascinating. They crossed left and right. They crossed urban and rural. You know, when you get 69% of the vote in a fairly conservative county, that really says something. And I just want to jump ahead because what happened in the very late part of the decade, a different company, Crystal Geyser, tried to do the same thing, found a site in Lewis County in Western Washington. And if you know Lewis County, you know it's probably just about the most conservative county in Western Washington. And there as well, they attempted to set up a spring water site. And that fascinating coalition of local folks, rural folks, tribal members, the Cowlitz tribe, et cetera, opposed them. And eventually that county voted, the county commission effectively banned water bottling as well.
And that coalition, similarly inspired by the Cascade Locks fight in Oregon and by what was happening in Lewis County, there was even a state level effort, right, about 4 years ago to try to ban permits for bottling spring water across the entire state of Washington. What happened to that effort?
Well, that was an outgrowth of the Lewis County effort, successful Lewis County effort to ban water bottling. Those local folks were so upset about the fears of loss of control over local water and the threat to local water supplies as they saw that they pushed for a statewide bill. Former state senator Reuven Carlisle introduced a bill. It passed the Washington State Senate, and then it kind of died a slow death in the Washington House. Industry got involved lobbying against it and eventually managed to kill the bill. Washington would have been the largest jurisdiction in the world to effectively ban groundwater bottling by the industry. And while unsuccessful, it really, I think, demonstrates the potency of the concerns around water protection in an era of climate change, in an era of, you know, increasing water scarcity. And I think there's really something there. I think the fact that these local efforts cross the divides we're so familiar with, they managed to sort of break through the culture wars, cut across these left-right lines and urban-rural lines to really unite a fascinating diversity of constituencies around the protection of local water. I think there's something important to look at there.
Daniel Jaffe is an associate professor of sociology at Portland State University and the author of Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. Daniel, thank you so much for being here. It's a really fascinating read, and it told me a lot about bottled water I never would have considered, and also the local connection to this fight against giving away permits for locally sourced water. It was a great read. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Libby. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.